Flyers Daily with Jason Mertidis.
It is a brand new edition of Flyers Daily, a Monday edition. Welcome to the month of June, everyone, and it's another hockey month. July, not much of a hockey month other than some free agency, but Flyers Daily presented, as always, by Ticketmaster. Make more memories live. It is a Monday. You know what that means? A Monday with Meltzer. Joining us from PhiladelphiaFlyers.com, NHL.com, and HockeyBuzz.com, it is Bill Meltzer. Bill, you've been enjoying the playoffs and the Rangers exit?
That's I always enjoy a Rangers exit. Yeah, you know, we can put it this way, right? In the last 84 years, the Rangers are 83-84 and not winning the Cup. So, yeah.
94 is the only one. And I mean, it was spectacular, and the guarantee and the goaltending of Richter. They've got a lot of those pieces, Bill, but it didn't seem like against Florida in particular, the big horses really showed up to lead the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, they made that late push, you know, Panarin gets the goal, and then, you know, everybody, you know, hold your breath for the final minute and 30. But yeah, I mean, the big guns, the Kreiders, and even for the most part, till that goal, you know, Panarin was quiet for a while, and you got to give Florida a lot of credit. You know, I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for the play of Shesterkin, that might not have even gone six games. You know, it really, Florida pretty much dominated possession and scoring chances and all those things that, you know, doesn't always translate to winning, but they were the better team in the series. So I think ultimately the team that was playing better was the team that won.
And it was the team that was better 5-on-5, Bill. That's the one thing about the Rangers in these playoffs. They really relied on the power play. A matter of fact, the Rangers outscored their opponent in only one of the series. They outscored Washington by one goal, 5-on-5. Carolina, I mean, they just weren't able to get it done. And they, when you rely too much just on the power play, that's not a great recipe. Actually, they were outscored 5-on-5 by Washington 7-5, by Carolina 13-12, and Florida 9-7. Where do they go from here? Where do the Rangers go from here? Do they have some tough decisions to make?
It's really hard. When a team gets where the Rangers are, where you've now been a contender for a few years and you know, you can't make that final step, and you know, you have a lot of money committed to your core group of players. I mean, those final steps are the hardest ones to take sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's going to be interesting. I think they only have four defensemen, I think, that are signed for next year. You know, Lafreniere is a year away from needing an extension. They have to decide what they're going to do with Kako this offseason because he's restricted this year. They have a lot of hard decisions to make to take that final step. You know, they have the goaltending, but it's kind of in a little bit like during Lundqvist's career, where they had the superstar goalie and they had some stars on the team, but just whatever final piece is missing, and finding what that final piece to get you over the top is in many ways can be the hardest step once you get to that contendership level. So that's a great question. I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah. I think one of the things when I look at the Rangers, and this is where like you almost have to preach a little bit of patience, but I mean, that's a hard thing to do when, as you mentioned, 83 of 84 years, they only have the one cup. But if there was ever a case to be made for a run it back team, I think that's it, because it's hard to win a cup. It really is, and they ran into a buzzsaw in Florida. Florida's not going anywhere the year after, anyway. We'll see what they do, you know, with some of their free agents, and they have some key decisions to make. Does Florida? But I look at a team like the Rangers, and I go, that's one where you go, I think we run it back. Maybe we try and bolster a little depth, get a little better 5-on-5. But your marquee players are going to be your marquee players, and you got to move forward with it and get after it. And hopefully, they learn from this loss in a conference final this year. By the way, the performance from Ekblad and Forsling, I saw this. Marty Biron tweeted this out, our old buddy, former Flyer goaltender, and played for a bunch of teams. In the first round, that Ekblad-Forsling pairing against Kucherov, 0 goals in 5 games. The second round, played most against Pasternak, one of the most lethal goal scorers in the game, 0 goals at 5-on-5 in 6 games when that pairs on the ice. In the third round, played most against Zibanejad and Kreider, 0 goals at 5-on-5 in 6 games. Tells you the importance of not only a top defenseman, but a top pairing that works beautifully together.
Oh, no question. No question. Ekblad, because of injuries and other things, that's a guy who was, first overall pick in the draft and, never
in Philadelphia. Right.
Yeah. Right here in Philly. And I mean, you go back in time, the Flyers made a push to be able to move up and take and be able to grab that first pick that year. And ultimately Florida decided, there wasn't an offer. They decided not to do it. But, it just goes to show, building on the thing we talked about last week, where defensemen take time, and when you can get that true first pairing guy, that they really are worth their weight in gold when you have one. So
to me, it's like the quarterback in football. If you don't have the franchise quarterback, you're looking for him. If you don't have him, and you can check that box, you can look at the other stuff as well, and that's what a top pairing guy is. Bill, we're watching these playoffs, and we're going to get to some Flyer stuff here in just a moment, obviously. But, the thing about it is you watch the teams that are advancing and you go, okay, what can we learn from those teams? And we've talked about this on a couple of episodes about how these teams were built. And you look at the Rangers and they send the letter, and some people called that a rebuild. They had some built-in advantages, obviously, being New York with Panarin, Adam Fox, and kind of the way it played out, and they didn't strip it down to the bones either. Kreider remains, Banajad remained, and on down the line. But you look at Florida, and boy, they're a case for a team. Yeah, Ekblad's a top of the draft guy, but the way they really built this team out with their depth is through free agency and trades, and none bigger than Matthew Tkachuk, because he is an absolute animal, and he is built for four rounds of playoffs year in and year out. He has affected this series in an enormous way.
Oh, without a doubt, obviously.
How do we find one of those, Bill? And I don't just mean a player like Tkachuk; I mean a Tkachuk.
Yeah. Well, there are other Tkachuks in the league, so
there is a Brady.
There's a Brady. The way Florida was built, obviously Barkov was a top of the draft guy too, and he's been crucial. I mean, that's a Selke level kind of center. So that there's your top center and your number one defenseman, and but I think a large part of what Florida's done in building the roster is, and it's something that their general manager Bill Zito has specialized in back from when he was an agent. He's been able to find guys who are either flying under the radar or, were capable of more than they were doing up to that point in their career. A guy like Verhaeghe, right? Verhaeghe could have been had by anybody. And that's a guy who, was signed by Florida and ended up becoming an impact player for them. And that's what you need, those later round draft picks, those guys who kind of hide in the weeds a little bit. And, at least for those the beginning, the beginning of the point when they're with you, those are cost efficient players who produce at a higher level. Particularly in the cap age, I think that's critical that you have some guys who kind of step out and surprise. And that's something you can see. You look at Tampa's Cup teams, right? Braden Point was not a top of the draft guy, and Kucherov was not a top of the draft guy.
Yeah.
So that's, I think that's something you can learn from those teams, too, that you have to build in a variety of means. People talk about the teams that have the top of the draft picks. And of course, it certainly helps to have those guys. But there's not just one way how to build a team. You look at Vegas. They're not really a team that was built through the draft, right? They were a team that brought in guys and were willing to go get them. I think that one thing that sets, I think, top general managers, maybe apart from other ones, is when you have a player who you covet, you think you do what it takes to get them.
Yeah, you find a way.
You find a way. And sometimes you have to par with a little bit more than you want to in the short term. But there's a player you truly covet who you think can be a central piece for your team. You go out and you do it. And you can use examples from that from many, many points in history. When you have that top end guy, you're gonna have to give up some quality to get quality, but if that guy really is the guy who's gonna drive the engine for your team, you do it. You find a way to do it.
You incur the risk because you believe in it, and you have to have that conviction. A lot of times you see on social media quite a bit, the 200 by 85 player, like a all zones forward. You look at Barkov, and you mentioned, I mean, he's a Selke level forward, just unbelievable at all ends, all areas of the ice. Tkachuk is as well, Bill. I mean, prior to that game six, when he was on the ice, Tkachuk, Florida outshot the Rangers 68-28. They out-attempted New York 169-69. They outchanced the Rangers 79-33, and they outscored the Rangers 10-4. I mean, a guy just has so much impact.
Sure.
You know, I know when we get to this draft, people are going to be going, got to get a pure scorer. But to me, you got to get a really good hockey player.
Yeah, for sure. And one thing that Florida does well, and, you know, and I think that was, to me, ultimately the biggest factor in that series, particularly with Tkachuk. When they got the puck, they didn't give it up. Yeah. You know, they were able to obviously move the puck effectively out of their own end, but they were able to make – a lot of the Rangers' top guys have to expend their energy defensively. You know, so when they ultimately got the puck, all they could really do a lot of times was chip it out and go off for a line change. And that's their top-end guys and dangerous players. You know, the Zibanejads and the Panarins. If you make them work without the puck, you neutralize a lot of their offense in the time being. And obviously, you know, you want to score, too. Against a guy like Shesterkin, you have to earn what you get, but you know, but the more offense that you play and the less you have to defend, you want to defend well too, of course. But the more you make the other team play without the puck, play in their own end, that does a lot of the work for you ultimately. And over a season, over a playoff series, you know, there might be games where you control the puck but you don't win. But ultimately it has a cumulative effect where you're going to wear a team down, and I really thought the Rangers, although they did make that late push, they look pretty, you know, pretty out of gas by the third period, I thought, for the most part.
Yeah, that's a team that will wear you down, and their size helps in that as well.
Sure.
Last thing on that series, Bill, you know, we preach about goaltending, and you need it in the playoffs, and once again, punching his second ticket to the NHL Stanley Cup Final is Sergei Bobrovsky, and this is always a convenient time for the low-hanging fruit people to throw out the trade about Sergei Bobrovsky, I think back in, 2012, if I recall. There's a lot of circumstance here. People like to paint it with a broad brush, and to me it's irresponsible to do it that way. So let's go back to 2012, because it has been painful watching Bob win multiple Vezinas, not as a Flyer. We know how the Ilya Bryzgalov situation ended up panning out, which is a big part of this story why Sergei Bobrovsky was traded after not being drafted and signing with the Flyers. But when you go back and you see Bob going to his second final and all the successes that he's had, and you look back at that trade, what was kind of the byplay that was happening at that time and why it did take place?
Yeah, I think context is everything, right? Yeah. Let's go back to the 2010 finals against Chicago. We all know what happened in that series. You know, after Michael Layton had three shutouts in the series against Montreal, really the goaltending on both sides, Chicago was leaky too, but the Flyers were just a little bit leakier. And goaltending probably in the end cost the Flyers that series.
Yeah.
So the Flyers scored plenty of goals. They were able to get pucks past, you know, the Duncan Keiths of this world, and they were able to create offense. And every time they seemed down, they would come back and score a goal. Or they, you know, there they are. They get the series 2-2 back to Chicago, and so the goaltending ultimately was a letdown for the Flyers by the end of that series. What happened the summer of 2010? Well, the Flyers looked at a variety of goalies that summer. The most intriguing possibility that summer, that was the year that the Flyers ultimately had to move Simone Gagné. The Flyers had an offer on the table from Boston. It would have been Tim Thomas,
yep,
in exchange for Gagné. Then, you know, then you look at what Tim Thomas did the next year. Won the Vezina, you know,
Cup.
Won a Stanley Cup,
yeah,
right. Won the Conn Smythe Trophy, and the Flyers, you know, the Flyers ended up and Bobrovsky was a rookie that year, and he had a good strong regular season, but then he came up a little short in the playoffs. Then you had a goalie carousel. It was Bob, and then it was Bush, and then even Michael Layton coming back off of an injury, got in a couple games, and the goaltending was a major problem. You know, you're holding your breath or during that postseason.
It was easy to put your finger on the issue.
It was easy to. And Ed Snyder, and it really was Ed Snyder's doing, he you know, literally, and this is in Jay Greenberg's Flyers at 50, literally pounded his fist on the table and said he wanted a solution to the goaltending problem, and he wanted it now.
Yeah.
Right?
Patience was not going to be the answer there.
No. And Ed Snyder was getting along in years and knew, you know, you only get so many kicks at the can. He wanted another cup, you know, and however many years he had left. And he knew that the Flyers' chance was right then. They'd been in the finals the year before. They were, I think, a point out of winning the Eastern Conference in 2010-11. And he knew that, you know, this is even before Pronger's career-ending injury.
Yeah.
But, you know, he knew Pronger's aging and Thiemann is aging, and he wanted to. So, and Paul Holmgren and Jeff Reese, who was the goalie coach at the time, said, Bobrovsky's going to be fine. He's a really good young goalie. We think he's, you know, we think he's going to be number one for a long time in the league. And it's not understanding, and rightfully so, because look what just happened in two previous playoffs. Well, can you guarantee me he's ready right now to make a deep run?
Yeah.
And they couldn't honestly say that. He was a young goalie, got off his first year in the NHL. And what did Brizgalov done? He'd won a cup in Anaheim, albeit mostly as a backup, but he won a couple big games in the playoffs.
Yep.
And then he was a Vezina finalist for the Coyotes. And he was the Coyotes MVP again the next year. And, you know, he was going to be a free agent. And so the thought process at the time with Ed Snyder was, well, we know what this guy can do. We know he has a cup ring. We know he's been a top finisher for the Vezina. Let's go get that guy.
Yeah.
And what are you going to do if your boss is literally pounding his fist on the table that he wants this guy? You get him the guy.
Yeah, yeah, and you don't have a choice. So he's the boss.
You don't have a choice. And, right. And so the Flyers signed Briz for 9 years. And we all know how it turned out. But, you know, you go back to that period of time, you know, the Flyers certainly have points that next year. Certainly looked like a contender. And they beat Pittsburgh in the first round.
Yeah.
And then it kind of melted down against Jersey. And Bob was not happy being a backup. He wanted to be a starter.
He didn't see a path to the crease. Yeah, I mean.
Right, yeah. I mean, Briz is signed for 8 more years. Deal.
Yeah.
Right. So I was like, well, I'm not going to be a starter here anytime soon. And so through his agent, he requested a trade. And, you know, their leverage was, we're going to send Sergei back to the KHL if he doesn't get the trade. And, you know, and basically the Flyer said, and it's in Jay's book, okay, don't publicize that you want the trade.
Yeah.
Keep it quiet and we'll find a way to move them. So that's how the trade went down to Columbus. But there's all these pieces, all these things that happened over a course of several years that got the Flyers to that point. And even with the trade to Columbus, yes, Bob won. Actually, it's his first Vezina the very next year.
Yep.
The Flyers ended up with Steve Mason, who had a pretty good career in Philly. Yeah. If you ever look at Mason's numbers in Philadelphia and Bobrovsky's career numbers, they're almost identical. Now, Mason was great at home and kind of average on the road. But anyway, his overall numbers in Philly were pretty good. I don't know if the Flyers would have gotten further in those years, especially as they're starting that rebuilding process after 2014. You know, so I don't know how it all would have turned out, but you can't just go back and say, oh, it's just one of the worst trades they ever made without applying any context to it. You need to know what preceded it, what else was out there that they didn't do, and how they regretted the things that they didn't do. You know, they could have made worse mistakes. They could have ended up with Nabokov, who was done.
Yep.
They could have ended up with Marty Turco, who was done. And, you know, they ended up with a better goalie in Mason than any of those other options. Obviously, you know, Tim Thomas being the exception. But the point being that, you know, you can't go back and rewrite the history. You have to know what proceeded and how it all played out.
Well, that would have been really interesting covering Tim Thomas as a Flyer goaltender.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I get along with a lot of the goalies and the goalies very well. I don't know how that relationship would have gone. He is a... Yeah. He got a lot of Dave Belfour in him.
Yes,
very surly,
yes, he does.
Kind of guy.
And by the way, we were talking about Bill Zito before. That was one of Zito's first clients.
Oh, really?
You know, yeah. Zito, Zito made his reputation as an agent because he would find players who were very lightly regarded. Tim Thomas was one of his first clients. Brian Rafalski, Billy Leno, you know, and basically, Columbus said, "Well, geez, as an he's an agent, but he thinks like a scout. He can identify all these players who teams are overlooking. Why don't we ask if he wants to come over to the management side?" And that was really how his GM career got started.
I always think it's good too to have that agent experience because there's nobody better at assessing value. Real value on players than a guy who was a former agent. I think it's a great skill set to have. Bill, now we kind of covered the playoff teams. This time last year, one of the things that we discussed quite a bit was what does progress look like for the 2023-2024 season for the Flyers. Now we were under the notion and the mindset that Provorov was gone, and so you're top pairing, highest minutes defenseman that played every game was not in the lineup. And who's going to step in and fill that void? Their second leading scorer in Kevin Hayes, gone, traded. They made some other moves. JVR, obviously, Tony DeAngelo. Who's going to step up? Are young guys going to step into the void? The leadership. What about Kateriak? All these things. We didn't just see a path to see growth in the standings. So we were trying to figure out what progress looked like. Progress was in the standings, and it was certainly evident with our eyeballs as well as they played meaningful 82 games this past season. But what does progress look like from the 23-24 season into the 24-25 season? Because we talk about players and the development arc is not just straight line up. I think in this stage of a rebuild, you do need to be making incremental steps forward. A step backwards in the standings or anything else is a step backwards. And I think that they need to – that will not be progress. We won't be able to quantify that as progress. So what does progress look like in your eyes coming up for this season?
I think that this year was an abnormal year in regards to the fact that, the Flyers were playing a meaningful game in Game 82 – part of that was that the teams that were competing for those spots, particularly in the Metro, but just competing for those couple of wild card spots at the end too, they weren't winning either.
Yeah, right. Islanders, and so, Washington, Pittsburgh.
And you look up at the end of the night, and those teams lost too.
Yeah, you lost no ground. You lost 4 out of 5. You lost no ground. It's weird.
Right. And so, I don't think you can necessarily say, okay, well, progress is the playoffs next year, because usually about where the Flyers finish this year is not going to, you're playing out the string by the last 2-3 weeks of the season. So I think progress this year is measured in, I think in terms of points, I'd like to see the Flyers finish with more points than they did last year, get up in the 90s somewhere. The Flyers this season had the rare feat. Even teams that are 100-point teams don't typically beat every other team in the league at least once. The Flyers almost did that. They did that. They beat everybody except Nashville at least once.
Tie. So the Flyers, an overtime loss. Yeah.
Yeah. And so they had at least a point, right, against everybody. You're not going to do that every year. I mean, the Flyers swept Vancouver, and look how far Vancouver got this year, right? Yeah. But I think that I think I'd like to see them score, obviously, a little bit more 5-on-5. And the power play has to get better, too. Keep the PK can stay at about a similar level. And then, there's pieces within that, too. Certain players need to step up. You'd like to find, that number one center. But even if you don't, I think that the team is capable, even if they're scoring by committee, to produce a little bit more offensively. You can't rely on scoring 16 shorthanded goals a year. The power play has to get better. Yeah. So I think that a better 5-on-5 differential and a better power play and slightly more points to me as a team would be progress. And then you could get into what players you'd like to see get better.
Yeah, obviously there's a lot of individuals that are going to contribute to progress if it is to take place, whether that's guys like Owen Tippett becoming a 30-goal scorer, Tyson Forster getting into that 28-32 range where, I mean, God, if you just have a good power play, you're going to end up there by proxy for those guys. But then can Konechny continue to do what he does, pending, obviously, what's going to take place this summer with the contract? It doesn't have to take place this summer. And Frost, and, you know, can York go to another gear? Sanheim, what do those pairings look like? Drysdale's health, goaltending. I mean, progress is going to be predicated on a lot of, you know, individual elements as you put it all together. To me, I think you're right. You got to play 82 games, but not in a situation where it's kind of like the tallest short guy in the circus kind of thing that gets in.
Yeah.
I can't say that the old way anymore. But, you know, 91 points, 92 points, and see if you're falling into a playoff spot. To me, that's progress. You just can't be like, oh, we just got knocked out of the playoffs in the last game of the year and have it play out where nobody can buy a win at the end of the season with these teams in Washington, and Washington ends up getting in. And so, yeah, we're going to see. It's going to come down to a lot of individuals and coaching. I think the power play, you're dead on. There's a lot of coaching in the power play, and that's got to be something. The whole thing's just got to be way better. I mean, Bill, if they come back and they're below 15% again, I don't even know what to say, because they don't have 15% below power play percentage pieces. They have more than that.
No, for sure. And, you know, we discussed this, I think, in a previous episode where you look at a team like Seattle. You don't look at their roster and go, boy, I wish we had their talent.
Yeah.
Right? San Jose, boy, I wish we could trade rosters with them. But they were both over 20% of the power play, because it's not only a talent thing. A lot of it is, you know, how you're coached, executing the simple things well, and just, you know, finding what works for you. And they never really found what worked. And when they would find something that would work for a while, they'd get away from it, right? As soon as it stopped working, they would shuffle personnel around again, you know, so on and so forth. They never really found their bumper shooter, no net front presence. I mean, all the things that went into power play being as ineffective as it was. All these, you know, you're maybe not going to solve all those elements in 1 year, but you can certainly get better. Even if you're not 20%, 18% would put you in the bottom third of the league, but at least it's respectable, right?
Yeah.
At least make it step towards respectability and then go from there.
The thing is a power play so predicated on, you know, everybody being on the same page and strategically, because you have the advantage constantly changing the personnel. A lot of times it's a fool's errand, because it's just, if it's cold or doesn't start out well, you got to just stick with it. You have to. And trying to put guys that you know are not power play players into that position just to try something different, to me, doesn't work. So I think you have to put your most skilled guys out there until they figure it out. You can't just, I mean, like, no offense to Garnet Hathaway, he's not a power play player in the NHL. He's just not. And you can't be into the position where you gotta try that because you're so desperate. We'll see where they go with that, and we'll see how that plays out, and will be one of the storylines certainly of next year. Bill, great stuff as always. Enjoy the Cup Final. We'll be back next week with Bill for another Mondays with Meltzer as we march on towards the draft. We're getting closer. Unbelievable. It's not that far away at this point. Cup Final underway as well. And we'll be back Wednesday. Our Flyers Exit Day interview series will continue. Here's who we have this week, by the way. We've got Cam York and Nick Seeler. And Travis Sanheim and Jamie Drysdale next week. Forster and Brink the week after that. And then Noah Cates will wrap it up the week after that as we head towards the draft. Everybody, thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. We'll talk to you next time on a brand new episode of Flyers Daily.